From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Americans are celebrity gaga. Okay, maybe not all of us. But take last night's Emmy Awards. 13.5 million people tuned in to check out the famous. Well, musician David Was thinks he's found an example of celeb worship taken too far. He's talking about the auction of two celebrity toilets.
Whether it's Britney Spears' lopped-off locks or Elvis Presley's empty pill bottles, the personal effects of celebrities are the modern-day equivalent of medieval religious relics. But it's far easier to comprehend why someone would want Michael Jackson's sequin glove than to fathom why someone's commode would interest anyone other than a plumber or a trash collector. One of the toilets for sale belonged to the fastidiously private J.D. Salinger, whose attempt to disappear from the world's radar was thwarted by his daughter's posthumous memoir and reams of snooping and speculation. To add ignominy to insult, the couple that bought his Cornish, New Hampshire home steered his toilet to a North Carolina auctioneer who had it listed last week on eBay for $1 million. The object was touted as having been owned and used by Salinger. The phrase "too much information" springs to mind. For those whose interest hews to the private lives of rock stars, a lovely blue-and-white porcelain number once owned by John Lennon was sold at a Beatles memorabilia auction in Liverpool last week for nearly $15,000. "Imagine no possessions," Lennon famously wrote. "I wonder if you can." The answer is a resolute no. Everything is for sale, especially if a celebrity touched, breathed upon, or otherwise utilized it. And the world. A quick perusal of the online auction world reveals a treasure trove of A-list detritus on the block, from Jackie Kennedy Onassis's dirty oven mitts to an empty hair color bottle used by Kurt Cobain that sold for $175. Add to that Jack Nicholson's baby teeth, "You can't handle the tooth," a cough drop spit out by Arnold Schwarzenegger, and a Daily Variety delivered to and read by Marlon Brando. I once loaned a paperback to Bob Dylan entitled "Jesus, An Historian's Review of the Gospels" by Michael Grant. He devoured it in a week's time, arriving at the studio every morning with the book rolled up and crammed into his front pants pocket. It is disheveled, missing several critical chapters, and you can have it today for a starting bid of, shall we say, $10 million?
Musician David Was lives in Los Angeles.
If your email is driving you crazy, if you're getting too many in your inbox and you feel like it takes too long to sort through and clear it all out, welcome to the world. Market researchers say nearly 300 billion emails are sent each day, and the average person sends and receives 110 messages. To the rescue, perhaps, is Google. Today, the company is releasing a new program for its Gmail service that will supposedly set priorities for the inbox. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Not sure which email to read first? Wrong emails turn up in the spam box. The new Google system sorts through all of your emails, and it puts the important ones in a separate priority inbox.
The magic here is really that it's personalized.
Matthew Glotzbach is one of the engineers who figured out how to assess your behavior and the contents of your messages and sort out what's important.
Looking at the people that you're emailing with back and forth and looking at your actions, like which messages you've replied, which messages you've starred, you know, and which messages you've deleted, to try to get a sense for what's important to you at what time.
Glotzbach claims that in Google's testing, people who use the new system saved about a week's worth of time over the course of a year. Inboxes are a big time suck, says Martha Egan, the author of Inbox Detox.
Any technology that can help people choose what's important and what isn't can be valuable if used in the right way.
Got that? She said, if used the right way. Gmail may be able to learn based on your past actions, but what if you think too many things are important?
When you're trying to manage your email and your inbox, managing yourself is more important than managing all of those emails.
Egan says some people even get so obsessed with using time management software that they waste even more time.
They become a slave to the technology and spend more time managing the technology than using it as an advantage to them.
The question is, how can you develop technology that gets around the human tendency to waste time? Dr. Michael Fried is working on an answer. He's a researcher at SRI, a nonprofit that does research for government and business. Fried wants your inbox to actually do tasks for you.
What you'd like to experience is have your email client say, hey, looks like this message requires that you go change the sales forecast for Acme upwards by 15K for the third quarter. How about if I just go change cell C23 and make that change for you?
Fried says we are getting closer to the day when that will be possible. But he does see Google's new tool as an advance that's a step up from just having a spam box. Still, for some, says Fried, the best answer may be an old-fashioned human assistant, who at least for now is likely to still have plenty of work to do. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
As we just heard, value-added analysis looks at students' performance on standardized tests from year to year, and then it links teachers to the gains their students make or don't make. North Carolina's Winston-Salem Forsyth County School District began using value-added analysis 3 years ago as a way to evaluate its teachers, and the school's district superintendent, Donald Martin, joins us now. Dr. Martin, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Robert.
And how big a part does value-added analysis play in your assessment of your teachers?
Well, it's certainly an important part for teachers. It's also an important part for schools. I will say that our State Board of Education, I think very wisely, passed a policy that says that information is exactly like the teacher evaluation instrument that we would have in a person's permanent record file.
And therefore it's not public information.
It is not public information in North Carolina. It is treated as your evaluation document, and it is confidential information.
But how big a factor of a teacher's evaluation is it, that analysis?
Well, for us, if the system is very simple. It's red, yellow, and green. Those are pretty easy ways to look at it. If you're red, your students are performing two standard errors below your sort of comparable counterparts. If you're yellow, you're right in the average performance. If you're green, you're two standard errors above. And if a teacher has one red, their first year, then we literally just have it's like a growth conference with them. They have a personal, individual plan. We talk to them about what are they going to do differently next year. Then as a second year, if there are two reds in a row, a teacher has consecutive reds, then we have a trigger for what we call a plan of assistance. And that plan of assistance may involve going to training. It may involve sending in some central office folks to work with that person and to really work on, a very formal plan that's now, could trigger dismissal at the end of the year if it is unsuccessful.
Let me ask you this question about value-added analysis. If I said here are 10 classrooms and five of them are teachers who have red ratings and five of them have greens, and I didn't tell you who was who when you went and looked at the classrooms. Do you think you would be able to figure out who the greens were and who the reds are? Or is this information at odds or irrelevant to standard ways of evaluating teachers' performance in the classroom?
In a single observation, I actually think you might be able to in a single observation. I am sure you could in multiple operations.
And principals,
multiple observations.
Principals typically are not surprised to learn who's the red and who's the green. Those are the teachers they assume would be in those categories.
They are not surprised. I think if you cross across the country, though, you will find that teacher evaluation systems are kind of a Lake Wobegon issue. Everybody's above average,
mm-hmm.
and I think you will find that there's always the wiggle room and the culture. And it's not just a school district culture; it's almost a national culture of teacher evaluations. And I look at that, if there's somebody to blame, it's central office. It's our group is to blame. And we have to talk about sort of an honesty in the evaluation process.
What do you make of the LA Times decision to make the information public?
Well,
if it's very useful, why shouldn't parents know this? Who's doing well?
It's the kind of, if we had 10 people for every job and you could just dismiss everyone and do that, because if you could teach, it's just like with any evaluation instrument. We have a duty. And in fact, we have to, by necessity, try to work with our teachers and improve their instruction. We've got to work with them to perform.
But just to summarize, as for what the LA Times did, if that were done in your system, you would not welcome that, is what I is what I hear you
exactly.
saying.
Exactly. I would not welcome that because I think it, and I'm glad it's basically against our state board policy.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's good.
Well, Superintendent Martin, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's Donald Martin, who is superintendent in the North Carolina Winston-Salem Forsyth County School District.
And today's last word in business is warmed over. Fine food enthusiasts were filled with disappointment last fall when the publisher Condé Nast announced it was shutting down the magazine Gourmet. The publication has been enticing readers with recipes and photos of mouth-watering dishes for nearly 70 years, then it went away. But like any good cook, you don't throw things away, you make something new with the leftovers. And Condé Nast is bringing back the magazine. It's coming out with three special editions magazines using recipes from previous issues. The first will be called Gourmet Quick Kitchen. It hits newsstands next Tuesday and will cost the gastronomical price of $11. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Of course, one surefire way to make eggs inedible is to leave them in the trunk of your car. A while back, we asked via Facebook and Twitter, what's in your trunk?
If you had asked me about 7 years ago, there would have been 36 eggs that I had forgotten for several months were in there.
Well, at least Amy Butler of Delaware didn't have to worry about salmonella. Here's what a few more of you have lurking in your trunks.
Okay.
Baby powder. If you ever get ants in your car, they won't cross the baby powder.
A baby sling, two cloth diapers, a couple of flannel wipes for the diapers. You can see that the stay-at-home mom thing is taking over my life.
I have an old Sesame Street dollhouse that I can't bear to throw away. So it's kind of like my secret.
Four fishing poles.
Four umbrellas.
On my commute to and from work, I pass four fisheries. If I've got a few moments and some gumption, which I often do, I'll stop and hit one of them.
We carry all those umbrellas in case of an emergency and also if people need them at church.
Alternator, a starter, spark plug wires, jack. Yes, I could use a cell phone and call a tow truck, but come on, that takes all the fun out of it.
No, Jack. I worked in an auto wrecking yard for 7 years, and I've had enough grease and grime on me that I've got AAA. If I get a flat tire, I'm going to have somebody else change it.
One very large plastic bag for my friend who's going to physical therapy sits on and then rotates when she gets in.
I have a wheelchair in my trunk because my husband is disabled. Two shopping bags, some kind of an interesting screwdriver. And there's off, which is really weird because I don't use it and I don't know who put it in here. And there are some dirty dishes. It's organized chaos.
That was Ann Weber, Rebecca Bradshaw, and Mary Farkas from California, joined by Clara Schuler from South Carolina, Kathy Kosod from Tennessee, Alan Hina-Strosa from Utah, Diane Evans from Pennsylvania, Toby Erickson from Michigan, and Guy Lavallee from Maryland.
You can become a fan of Morning Edition on Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter at Morning Edition or at NPR Inskeep.
In the next few minutes, we're going to enter the world of roller derby.
All right, Los Angeles, I've got one question for you. Are you ready for roller derby?
We are, and our guide is a voice you've heard on NPR, reporter Alex Cohen. Public radio reporter by day, that is, by night. For several years, Alex Cohen was known exclusively by her derby name, Axles of Evil. On a recent morning, Alex welcomed us to a giant warehouse on the edge of downtown Los Angeles that was once an ice cream cone factory.
This is what is affectionately known as the Doll Factory, and there is actually, if you can see, a neon roller skate that when turned on is hot pink. So it's home to the Los Angeles Derby Dolls, which is LA's Bank Track Female Roller Derby League.
Bank Track. That refers to the sloped track where skaters can get going really fast, which is, of course, at the heart of roller derby. Axles of Evil has written with another one-time derby doll, Jennifer Casey Bomber Barbie, what they call an insider's guide, down and derby. It's a sport that Alex Cohen never expected to be part of.
I'm 5'2 on a good day. I have never been athletically inclined. I was always kind of the theater and speech and debate geek. And when I started doing Derby, I was really amazed to see that I actually really like beating people up.
If you know one thing about roller derby, you know it's rough. And Trixie Biscuit, one of the derby dolls at a recent practice, is proud to be one of the roughest.
I'm a bigger skater than a lot that you'd see. I've always been a bruiser. You know, I was the catcher on the softball team that, you know, go ahead, slide into me. Try it. See where it gets you.
Trixie Biscuit's real name is KT Wegman. She's a mom who came to Derby in her 30s after serving as a sergeant in the Army Reserve. The way she sees it, Derby is her destiny.
Gnarly block from Trixie Biscuit against Crava Cadaver, who's jamming for the Arizona Derby Dames.
If anyone can be credited with inventing roller derby, it's a man named Leo Seltzer. Roller skating competitions had been around since the 1880s for men. But decades later, Leo Seltzer put women on skates and in short skirts and sent them on the road in his 1935 Transcontinental Roller Derby. Alex Cohen says the derby guys and gals piled into team buses with trainers, announcers, and trunks full of skating outfits.
It was kind of like a traveling circus. A lot of it was born out of the Depression. So you had young kids who basically gave up their lives, traveled the country, became families with each other. I mean, these were the same skaters that were building the track that they would skate on that evening. I mean, it was just this grueling, grueling endeavor. They got paid no money, but it was their chance at this tiny little sliver of fame.
Over the years, among the biggest crowd pleasers have been rivalries between opposite types, the sweetheart and the mean girl. Jennifer Casey Bomber Barbie says it all started with two gals back in the 1930s.
There was this woman named Jerry Murray, and Jerry Murray was kind of the Betty Grable pinup of roller derby. She was this beautiful woman and very fashionable with her scarf that she would wear. And then there was another one named Midge Tuffy Brassoon, and she was this 4'11" spitfire plumber's daughter. And both of these women, you have to understand, at the time they were 15 and 16 years old when they joined roller derby in the 30s and through the 40s when they were skating. And they had these rivalries that were amazing, and the crowd loved to cheer for Jerry, loved to boo for Tuffy.
Both girls trying to get in. Here they come up the back end of the pack. Tuffy knocked down. That was a fast one. Tuffy Brassoon knocked down, and she is boiling. Well, this partisan chief crowd is giving Tuffy a little of their opinion as she argues with her coach, Buddy Atkinson.
At one game, the fans were so incensed at a move that Tuffy had made that a woman runs up to the track and threw her baby at her. I mean, that blows my mind. Luckily, Tuffy's also very lightning quick reflexes. She was an athlete after all, and she caught the baby, thank goodness. For me, that's roller derby in a nutshell right there. I want those kinds of fans. I don't want babies thrown at me, but I like that kind of passion.
The key to the fascination with women's roller derby is its mix of bold sexuality, females at their fiercest, and also a certain playfulness. Those qualities come out in the derby names. Georgia O'Grief, Tequila Mockingbird, Iron Maven, Judy Gloom. The one who gets to have fun with all those names is the derby announcer. The best score points with their witty commentary. Comedian Jimmy Fallon played an announcer in the recent Drew Barrymore movie about roller derby called Whip It.
Well, our favorite Whole Foods checkout girl is about to bag her some honey. Clean up on aisle five. With time left for only one more jam and the game out of reach, Smashley Simpson is out of here.
Women competing on skates first appeared in the movies back in 1946 in a short film called Roller Derby Girl. In 1972, Raquel Welch strapped on skates in Kansas City Bomber. By then, derby was fading. But in the last decade, derby has made a comeback. Now there are more than 17,000 skaters in more than 400 leagues. Fans pack into the Doll Factory here in L.A. to see Sheila Hot Wheels Noonan and other skaters go at it.
Out here at the LA Derby Dolls, you'll get your old school classic Cars fan. You'll get your punk rockers, you know, hipsters from the neighborhood. You get this really crazy cross section because it's this word of mouth. Like, I saw this thing. It was really neat. And there was all this other stuff going on. You should check it out. And people show up because of that reputation or because of that allure or the mystique. And then when they watch the game, it's not, you know, an alligator pit. It's actually a very difficult and highly choreographed game. You have to work very hard for every single minute of that hour-long game, and I think that's what brings people back.
Are you ready for roller derby action? Come on, Los Angeles!
If you think derby might be your destiny, you can take the Am I a Derby Girl quiz at NPR.org.
I'm talking about roller derby.
The Insider's Guide to Roller Derby, Down and Derby, is by Jennifer Casey Balmer Barbie and Alex Cohen, a.k.a. Axels of Evil. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Go, go, roller girl! Look at that girl roll!
Roller derby saved my soul.